I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Patriot Act is the topic of conversation in Congress today. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and FBI Director Robert Mueller defending the post-9/11 legislation, and a coalition of Democrats and Republicans calling for watering it down. Most of the law is permanent, but 15 provisions expire in December unless renewed by Congress. Joining us on the line is Tim Edgar, Legislative Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And let's take a look at some of those provisions that are set to expire. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified today defending the so-called library provision, saying it had only been used 35 times and never to obtain records on suspects from libraries, bookstores, hospitals, or gun shops. Your thoughts on that comment, first of all?
Well, it's fascinating that he would have declassified the number of times that the power was used. We've been asking for that number for 4 years now. And that's a huge increase since the last time that they discussed it 2 years ago when they said that it had never been used.
Well, and defenders of the provision would say that 35 times isn't a lot of times, and never in the way that people feared the most, using it to check on what people took out of the library, for instance.
Well, again, I think the problem is that using an unconstitutional power even once is too many times. The problems with that provision are that it doesn't allow the judge to consider whether a gag order is needed. Instead, it makes it automatic. It doesn't provide for any real mechanism for challenging the provision. We're asking that those changes be made. So it's quite possible that if we made those changes, the government would still have been able to get all of the records that it sought, but we would have had much greater confidence that it was using that power appropriately and that there wasn't a danger of future abuse.
And we point out that you're part of an unusual coalition of conservatives and liberals calling for changes to the Patriot Act. You'll all be holding a news conference this afternoon proposing more changes you'd like to see.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little more about what you'd like to see?
Sure. The coalition's going to be supporting a bill introduced by Senator Craig, a Republican conservative from Idaho, and Dick Durbin, a Democrat. And we are proposing the idea that these records-gathering powers should be limited clearly to situations where the government can show individual suspicion that the person they're looking for is a bad guy, is a terrorist or a spy or a foreign agent, rather than being allowed to be used whenever the government says they need them for an investigation. So we're asking for essentially a standard that would guide the judge when they were considering these applications and would make that requirement of a judicial order less of a rubber stamp. Mm. We're also going to be proposing specific language to allow people to challenge those orders on the basis that they invade a person's privacy and that the gag order violates their right to speak out. And so it would give more power to a judge to oversee the way these orders are being issued and used.
Did Mr. Gonzalez say anything today about allowing people access to judges and access to more representation?
Well, he did, I think, indicate some willingness to look at some of these issues. And so we're welcoming this new approach from the new Attorney General. As you know, the last Attorney General was adamant that any change to the Patriot Act, changes of the sort that Alberto Gonzalez is now proposing, would be some sort of victory for terrorism. And so this is certainly a good first step, a good new attitude on the part of the Attorney General. I want to make sure, though, that the changes are substantial and really solve these constitutional flaws and aren't simply window dressing to basically add lipstick to the pig of an unconstitutional power.
As we mentioned, some of the provisions of the act will expire, and that's why they're being debated in Congress today to see whether or not they should be renewed. But some are part of law. For instance, the so-called sneak and peek searches. This is when a search is done of your home or business and you're not notified until afterwards. What has the Justice Department said about defending those provisions?
Well, the Justice Department's been very aggressive in defending their power under the Patriot Act to go into a home or business without telling you, and just last before the hearing released numbers which they said showed that it's not used very frequently. And while these warrants are a small percentage of federal criminal search warrants, they are on the increase.
Again, the government and supporters of the Patriot Act saying that the sneak and peek searches have only been used 155 times, and that's only since 9/11. I guess, Tim, one last question. What do you say to supporters of the Patriot Act and these provisions who say, the proof is in the pudding. There have not been any attacks. There hasn't been any terrorism in the United States since 9/11, so the law should stand.
Well, I just think that they're making a huge logical leap here. The government has provided basically no evidence that they have used these powers to prevent terrorism or in terrorism cases. In fact, when they've discussed these powers, they've usually talked about ordinary criminal cases.
Tim Edgar, Legislative Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union, part of the bipartisan group Patriots to Restore Checks and Balances. Pope John Paul II will be buried this Friday, and today the College of Cardinals met for the second time to prepare to choose his successor. Who will succeed Pope John Paul II? The 117 cardinals will decide that question when they hold their conclave later this month, choosing from discrete lists of papabili, those who are considered qualified to be pope. And it's a decision that will be announced to the world with the ringing of bells and puffs of white smoke. The cardinals say they're looking to the Holy Spirit for guidance, but they doubtless will be also looking at more earthly matters, such as demographics. David Van Bima is senior religion writer for Time magazine. He's been attempting what he says is a sometimes fruitless task of reading the Vatican's tea leaves, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
And let's do some of the language first, because I said papabili, that's the lists of those who are, how would you say it?
We would say popable.
Popable.
The popables.
They have popability.
That's right.
Okay. Well, and these lists, as I said, are discreet, because it is considered bad form to talk about this publicly and certainly to campaign for this office.
That's right. It's been said that by the time the conclave actually meets, that they will have narrowed it down to about six people, which suggests that there's a tremendous amount of sort of clandestine or crypto campaigning that goes on, but none is officially allowed.
And what are some of the competing interests?
People are going to pretty much hew to John Paul II's line on doctrine and teaching. A lot of the stuff that ticks off some more liberal American Catholics is not going to change. But there are, as you say, different interests. There are people from the developing world for whom the discrepancy between the rich and the poor is a huge, huge issue. There are other people in Europe for whom the falling away of the flock is very concerning, and also the competition from Islam in Europe. And to some extent, America partakes of that first one as well.
Well, let's start by looking at one of the interests, which is, as you said, is geography. Two-thirds of Catholics now live in the developing world. Is there pressure on the cardinals to look to where the flock is roosting?
Yeah, there is pressure, but interestingly, although two-thirds of Catholics are from the developing world, only one-third of the voting cardinals are from the developing world. So what you would have to have would be some people who are sort of willing to overlook hometown loyalty and say, well, this is where the church is headed, and this is where the big issues are going to be, and therefore, even though he's not my neighbor in the next Italian city over, I still think he should be the next pope.
Well, let's learn about one of the leading candidates, Cardinal Claudio Hummes of Sao Paulo, Brazil. What do we know about him?
Well, Hummes is interesting. He has connections. He's not himself a liberation theologian, but he has connections and had connections with people who were proponents of liberation theology, which is a theology that had a little bit of socialist DNA in it that the Pope came down very hard on in the 1980s. Mm. I don't think Hummes can be called a liberation theologian, and to the extent that we're merely talking about trying to reduce the distance between the very poor and the very rich, he's very consistent with what John Paul II has been saying or had been saying for years. But it is sort of an interesting historical note.
Right.
The other thing about Hummes is that he represents an issue that is actually rather important within the church, although outside of it we don't talk about it much, which is that there are a lot of archbishops and bishops feel that power became too centralized in Rome during the last papacy. They would like to have a little bit more autonomy, and Hummes has spoken out for that, and that should make him somewhat popular.
Then there's Cardinal Oscar Andre Rodriguez Maradiaga from Honduras. He's 62, beloved in his home country, but he's made some controversial statements on the, specifically on the church sex abuse case. How would he be viewed, especially from America?
Well, in America, he would probably be viewed with a certain amount of caution because he did compare the media's uncovering of the sex abuse case to Hitler, which is not the kind of thing that we like to hear here. On the other hand, in some ways, I mean, he has been extremely strong in terms of trying to reduce economic inequities. He has campaigned with Bono for debt relief. He is charismatic, small-c charismatic. He's passionate. He speaks eight languages. In some ways, if you're looking for a pope who has a little bit of that John Paul II magic in terms of being a Renaissance man, being educated, being passionate, and so on, Rodriguez Maradiaga is like that, but he has kind of a big negative from the American point of view because of what we've spoken.
Well, we wonder, we said that 43% of Catholics live in Latin America, only a third in America and Europe. Does the Vatican and do the cardinals really care what American Catholics think?
Several people have said that they do not think that the sex scandal, that sex abuse scandal, is going to be a big deal at this conclave. So it might not hurt him all that much. It's possible. They don't want somebody, and this we owe to some extent to John Paul II, they do not want somebody who's constantly putting his foot in his mouth. And so just in terms of the way that you manage the press and that you manage the image of the church, it's possible that this could do him some damage. But in terms of the issue itself, outside of the United States, outside of North America, you would be amazed at how the sex abuse scandal sort of recedes because it never did get those kinds of headlines that it did here.
Let's look to Europe. One of the leading contenders is a man very close to the late Pope, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. He's 77 years old. He said the prayers during Good Friday and said, Lord, your church often seems like a boat about to sink, a boat taking in water on every side. In your field, we see more weeds than wheat. Very critical of what he would see as the wayward part of the Catholic Church. Is it fair to characterize him as one of the more conservative choices?
It is. He's not the sunniest man in the world. The thing about Ratzinger is he ran the Office for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the inheritor of it used to be known as the Inquisition. He was John Paul II's theological watchdog and enforcer. He, among others, believed that in some ways it would be better to have a church with a smaller number of members who are actually really good Catholics than one where you get the maximum number of members who aren't good Catholics. But he would represent, if they were interested in him, he would represent a continuity because he was almost a partner in this papacy. And he's old enough at 77 that he could be thought of as a quote-unquote transition pope, which would give people a little bit more time to figure out way they want the church to move without thinking that somebody's going to be running the show for another 26 years. One final interesting thing about him is that there's a new rule, which is if they cannot come up with somebody who can get a two-thirds majority after 33 votes, they go to a 51% majority to become pope. And that actually works in his favor because if you have a lot of enemies the way that he does as a result of his job, you're not going to get the two-thirds, but you might get the 51%.
David Van Bima is senior religion writer for Time magazine. Stay right there. When we come back, more candidates. And is there any chance a more liberal cardinal might become the next pope? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation about the men who could succeed Pope John Paul II. We're talking with David Van Bima. He's senior religion writer for Time magazine. And David, many of the cardinals mentioned as successors are in their 70s, including the one you just mentioned, Germany's Joseph Ratzinger. He's 77. So how much is age playing a role in this consideration?
Well, we'll find out. I mean, it could play a very large role. If people are looking, if people are looking for a transitional figure, they will look for somebody, you know, who's older. There are people, cardinals who would be acceptable who are older, and there are cardinals who are younger. If they choose somebody who's 59 or 60, it means they're really thinking of letting themselves in for another long papacy. They might do it, but then they would have to be darn sure that they wanted to live with that for that amount of time. The thinking at this point seems to be that if you are 60 years old, you don't have that great a chance because after such a long papacy, there is an interest in perhaps a shorter one next.
Right.
But whether or not they want somebody who's only going to be a pope for 5 years or 7 years, that's kind of yet a different issue, and that's where the Ratzinger consideration comes in, I believe.
Right. Another contender is also in his 70s. I'm thinking of Cardinal Francis Arinze from Africa. Your thoughts on him and the idea of extending, this role to someone from Africa? It wouldn't be the first pope from Africa, but what would it mean?
Well, it would be an extraordinary statement on the part of the Church. It would be a continuation of this notion of the developing countries, but Africa has far fewer voting cardinals than Latin America, and therefore the chances would seem to be decreased. Arinze has an interesting personal story in that he's a convert. He happens to be a convert from animism, but the thought is that he would be able to address the question of Islam, which is a very big one for the Church, given the inroads that Islam has made in Europe and in other places. Arinze, however, has been in Rome for something like 20 years at this point, and there is, some people would suggest that there is a real ambivalence about making a member of the Roman bureaucracy the next pope, because there is, similar to the feeling that I described before, there's a feeling that the bureaucracy accrued too much power during the course of John Paul II's papacy, and there's a desire to decentralize a little bit. So anybody who is seen more as a curia guy, as a bureaucracy guy, may have some strikes against them.
Well, I wonder if that applies as well to someone from Rome or from Italy, as, you know, John Paul II, the first non-Italian pope in hundreds of years. Any chance the cardinals will stay close to home and choose a cardinal from Italy?
I'd say there's an extremely good chance of that. People say the Italians had the papacy for 456 years and then lost it and have been working ever since to get it back again.
Really? Really? How do you mean that, working to get it back? Isn't that behind-the-scenes way?
I mean, nothing is ever done in an overt way. But they have the largest national contingent at the conclave. I believe that it's 20%, either 17 or 20%, which is far down from what it used to be, but it's still much bigger than the next biggest national group. And they have good connections and with other Europeans. If you take all the first world together, it comes to 49% of the voting cardinals. If the developed world decides that it wants to vote on an Italian, it can pretty much put an Italian over.
Right. And that wouldn't necessarily mean continuity. I'm remembering, wasn't it an Italian pope who convened Vatican II?
Well, he was a big surprise, and I think he's the great moral of this conversation that we've been having. And that is that, first of all, we can prognosticate all we want about who they'll pick and then be totally wrong. And secondly, they can pick somebody that they think is going to be transitional or who is going to be a mere avatar of continuity, and he can just surprise them. John the 23rd was not supposed to be a revolutionary pope, and yet he initiated the Second Vatican Council, which has changed the Church forever. So we need to be careful, as we predict or try to predict who they might choose, and they need to be careful when they choose somebody, because the person might not bounce the way that they're expected to.
But all but three of the cardinals were appointed by John Paul II. Is there really a chance that these who are appointed by John Paul II might make a break with recent past and go with a cardinal who would have different views on, let's say, issues of doctrine, on homosexuality, use of condoms to prevent AIDS? Is there really a chance?
You have to tell me who that was, because I personally do not know of anybody who has suggested that. There are some cardinals. The person who comes to mind is Daniels of Belgium, mm-hmm. Who have talked in the most cautious possible way about the possibility that at some point or another the Church might accept into the priesthood men who were already married. That is to say, not that you let an unmarried priest marry, but that if somebody's married and wants to go to seminary, he might become a priest. That's and in the most cautious of terms, but words like that have probably not made Daniel's case that much stronger. In terms of doctrine, in terms of Church teaching, of all the things, the strong stands that we most associate John Paul II with, It's rather unlikely that we're going to see a lot of change.
David Van Beem, a senior religion writer for Time magazine. David, thank you for spending some time with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And this note, there are 183 cardinals in all, but only those under the age of 80 can vote, bringing to 117 the number that will choose the next pope. In the meantime, Rome is preparing for Friday's funeral. Kings, presidents, and prime ministers will be in attendance. The delegation from the U.S. will include three presidents. President George Bush, his father, and former President Bill Clinton will be there, along with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Britain's Prince Charles has postponed his wedding so that he can represent Queen Elizabeth at the funeral. Still up in the air is China. Today, China warned the Vatican not to interfere with that country's internal affairs and said it doesn't know if a representative will go to Rome this week. Beijing has been critical of the Vatican's ties with Taiwan and has said that the country hopes its relations with the Vatican will improve following Pope John Paul's death. China's Catholic Church is government-sanctioned. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Members of a deadly rogue police faction in Brazil are under arrest in connection with the massacre of innocent civilians in Rio de Janeiro. 11 police officers are being questioned, suspected of taking part in last week's shooting rampage that left 30 people dead, including 5 children. Shootings allegedly in response to an internal investigation into corrupt police. For more on the story, we turn to Andrew Downey. He writes for the Christian Science Monitor and is based in Rio de Janeiro. Andrew, have there been any charges at this point?
No, the arrests were just came last night, so no formal charges have been made as yet. All 11 people who were arrested are members of the police, which is no great surprise in Brazil. Police officers, or the police force in itself, is known as a fairly corrupt body, and this is just one more example of the police going in and doing exactly what they're being paid not to do.
Well, we're going to hear more about a history of police abuse in Rio in a moment, but tell us first, what happened last week?
What appears to have happened was two cars of police officers drove into a poor community on the outskirts of Rio at about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock on Friday morning, and they opened fire indiscriminately from a car into a bar in a place called Nova Iguaçu, and they killed 15 people. And then about an hour later, same cars went into another community and opened fire on, one was a local square, and they opened fire on another shop, I think it was, and they killed about another 15 people. So far, the death toll is 30 and at least a dozen injured.
We've said that these police were allegedly reacting in response to a crackdown on other officers. But still, you know, begs the question, why would they shoot up a neighborhood?
There doesn't seem to be a lot of logic to this. When I spoke to the police this morning, they said what the police were trying to do was the police were trying to tell the population and tell the police, the police chiefs themselves, is that we are our own law. We will do what we want. You can go and you can arrest our fellow officers, but that won't stop us. We can do this and we can get away with it. And historically, that has always been the case in Rio. A lot of police can go in and they can do this and they've got away with it. They haven't been punished.
How are people who live there reacting to the fact that 11 officers have been arrested this time around?
Well, I think people are obviously pleased that officers have been arrested, but there's a lot of skepticism involved as well. These people have seen the police abuse them on a daily basis for many, many years, and they feel that this is just one more case of this happening, and they don't think that 11 arrests is really going to change the whole face of the police force.
Are there people in Rio, though, who are sympathetic with the police?
Yes, of course. Yes, of course. There are people. There are people who are sympathetic with the police, especially in the richer parts of the city where the policing is better and more thorough. You tend to find that people have more sympathy with the police. But in the poor communities where people say the police are just there to abuse them, that's where you have a lot of opposition to the police, and the police really aren't looked on in these areas with good eyes.
Andrew Downey writes for the Christian Science Monitor. He's based in Rio de Janeiro. Andrew, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks very much.
Well, as Andrew said, Brazil has a long history of human rights violations. For more on the case, we turn to Josh Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International. He joins us from Somerville, Massachusetts. And Josh, this attack was reportedly, as we said, in response to a crackdown on corrupt police in Rio. What do you know about that arrest or that crackdown?
Well, apparently, they have begun a crackdown called Operation Razor on the Flesh, which is supposed to be targeting death squads and violent police officers and military police officers who have been carrying out massacres like this for more than a decade. We'll see how serious this crackdown is, but apparently it was serious enough to provoke this kind of abhorrent massacre.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about that history of attacks. This is not at all the first time Brazilian police have, without provocation, attacked and even killed children.
That's right. We have reports in our files dating back to the early 1990s where we raise questions about such attacks in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo and in other cities. And, of course, one famous attack took place in 1993 in Candelaria where eight street children were killed, and that was followed by an attack in a shanty town called Vigário Geral, where over 20 people were killed. It happens that in the mid-1990s, Chau Feraz, a survivor of those attacks, had been campaigning in Brazil against such death squads, and he had to flee the country.
But Andrew alluded to part of the problem in Rio, which is that there are a lot of people who are sympathetic with the police. There's a huge problem of street children and street gangs in Rio, and some of the business owners back the police.
Well, that's part of the tragedy. The business owners hire paramilitary officers, off-duty policemen, to harass these kids, to get them out of the districts, and even to shoot them outright. And if we're going to uphold the rule of law, we not only have to arrest the police officers and insist on accountability within the upper reaches of the police, but we've got to go after the people who are sponsoring these attacks.
As you said, there is a crackdown, but this is such an old story in many ways. Why is it still happening? Are people afraid to speak out?
I don't think it's because there's fear to speak out. I think it's because there's a lack of political will, both within the city administration and within the national government. Everybody knows about this problem. I mentioned the case of Chau Feraz. He was actually awarded a National Human Rights Prize, and a week later he was so much under threat that the national government urged him to get out of the country. They didn't have the resources to protect him. So it's clear that there's no consistent political will at the national level. Now, we're hoping that President Lula da Silva, who comes from a background of being a political prisoner, of having been tortured, that he will step in and do something far more aggressive in this case.
Has he? I mean, you know, you mentioned the crackdown on the cops that led to this rampage. Can he point to that as part of his leadership?
Well, we would hope that this will be an occasion to really have a consistent program and not just go after a few officers. You know, we believe that as many as 50 officers were arrested in connection to the attack in Candelaria in 1993. In the end, I believe that only two were convicted. So the Brazilian justice system does not deal adequately with these cases.
I'm wondering, why hasn't there been more of an outcry outside of Rio? This is such a huge tourist place. If you ever travel to Rio, you see the signs, you know, warning you about thievery, but you also see, you know, how the street children are treated. Why aren't people speaking more about this?
I would imagine that in the Brazilian press, there's a tremendous amount of pressure to do something. But the fact is that the street children are seen as a nuisance, and society is not willing to live up to its responsibility to help these most vulnerable of residents of these cities.
Do you get any sense that this last shooting, 30 people killed, 5 children, might mean a turning point in how people both in Brazil and outside react?
You know, Robin, I would have thought back in 1993 that we would have said the same thing about the Candelaria massacre, that this will be the turning point, that no one could ignore this. Amnesty will be campaigning. We'll see if the national government and if city officials really respond.
Josh Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International. Josh, thanks.
Thank you.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. 617-358-0397. But please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, why you might want to travel from there to Traverse City, Michigan, or Antigonish, Nova Scotia this summer. You're listening to Here and Now. The cosmetics industry in the U.S. is now a $35 billion a year business, but is it also bad for your health? Increasingly, consumers are expressing concern about potentially dangerous chemicals most cosmetic companies use in their products, from blush and lipstick to hair dye. Joining us now, syndicated health columnist Judy Foreman. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
And what's the bottom line on this issue?
It's a mess. Basically, the cosmetics industry says everything you use for personal care products is safe. The environmental groups who have filed a petition with the FDA have a fair amount of evidence suggesting that a lot of products may not be safe. And the FDA does not have to regulate cosmetics very tightly, although they're starting to crack down. So it's kind of like a three-cornered mess.
Well, why doesn't the FDA have to regulate cosmetics or hair dye or things that you put on your body?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. I mean, historically, they are supposed to regulate food, drugs, and cosmetics, but they have not had to look at cosmetics before they go in the market. With drugs, even over-the-counter drugs like sunscreens and anti-dandruff shampoos, things that you might think of as cosmetics, but they're really drugs, those do get pre-market review by the FDA for safety. But everything else in the cosmetic department does not.
Right.
So basically, the consumer has no way of knowing what's really safe and what's not.
And it gets further complicated because I understand a lot of major cosmetic companies are marketing, you know, safer, more natural makeup lines, but they're not necessarily safer.
No. I mean, natural is a misleading term to start with because chemicals are natural and natural doesn't really mean anything. Neither does a term the industry uses a lot, like hypoallergenic. I mean, even if something doesn't cause allergies, it doesn't mean it can't cause cancer.
Right. So we have, as you've said, a mess, but the European Union seems to have found a way around it.
Yes, they passed this thing called Amendment 7 last September, which does ban certain things like a chemical called phthalates. That's P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E, if you want to look it up on the web. It's a softener. It's in a lot of things. It's in nail polish. It's in lotions. It's in moisturizers. And the European Union has said, yes, you can't use this. And several big companies like Revlon and L'Oreal and Unilever have said that they will abide by those standards. Whether they are or not, I couldn't tell. I did talk to all three companies, and they say they are abiding by those standards. But that may not go far enough for Americans because the FDA considers phthalates, as they use in cosmetics, to not be a problem yet, but they haven't really looked.
Right. So environmental groups are taking the lead on this and raising an alarm. But should we be alarmed?
I'm not sure. I think we should certainly look at it more closely because basically the only group that investigates the safety of cosmetics at all is the industry itself. It has a panel called the Cosmetic Ingredient Review Board, but the panel is funded by the cosmetics industry, and even that panel has only reviewed 1,200 ingredients in cosmetics, and the industry says there are 4,000, and the environmental groups say there are 10,000. Mm-hmm. So most of these ingredients have not been reviewed by anybody.
What are the chances of the FDA getting more closely involved?
I think they're excellent because in February, the FDA sent a warning letter basically to the industry saying that they're going to start cracking down, and if they determine that certain cosmetic products have not been adequately reviewed for safety, they're going to require a big warning label on the product saying this product has not been evaluated for safety.
Right. Well, in the meantime, as we wait to see if there's going to be more oversight by the government, what should the consumer do, especially if someone wants to err on the side of caution?
Well, let me say that a dermatologist I respect a lot said these products are probably safe because there have not been many reports tying them to diseases or injuries. But that said, if you want to find out what is in your cosmetics and what might be causing a problem, the Environmental Working Group has a terrific website, and they are the ones who filed a petition against the FDA or to the FDA to get the FDA to act on this. And their website goes through product by product with brand names, listing the chemicals that are in it, including listing chemicals that the cosmetics industry itself says are unsafe and that are still in some products.
Judy Foreman comments on health issues for Here and Now. Her syndicating column appears in papers today. For links to her column and to other websites, go to ours, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Advocates for the arts say the slashing of funding for the arts over the past few years appears to be leveling off. And that's good news, not only for big cities, but also small towns where arts-driven economic development is fueling revitalization. On the line from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is someone who's paid a great deal of attention to art towns in the U.S. and Canada, author John Villani. His book, The 100 Best Art Towns in America, is now in its fourth edition, and he joins us from the studios of KSFR in Santa Fe. And the fix might be in here because, John, what is the number one town on your list of top 10 art towns with populations between 30,000 and 100,000?
It has to be Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Winner. Why? What? I mean, we all know that Santa Fe has just this beautiful draw, but what is it about Santa Fe that gives it that spot?
It's that perfect combination of artists, infrastructure, and events. It's the fact that you have 10 art museums and more than 200 art galleries and more than 5,000 people that call themselves artists and year-round programming in the creative fields. The concept of an art town is really embodied by what Santa Fe is, but there's a number of other places around the country that have really strong local art scenes that are smaller than Santa Fe.
Right. And by the way, we should say on the list with Santa Fe, right behind it, Loveland, Colorado, Sarasota, Florida, Hot Springs, Arkansas, Asheville, North Carolina. What was your criteria for choosing towns? I mean, you mentioned a lot of the events that Santa Fe has, but what else?
Well, it's not always infrastructure and events. In Loveland, Colorado, it's more of an atmosphere in which artists are an integral part of the economic climate in that community north of Denver. So in Loveland's example, you have a town that's a great place for artists to live. So the criteria changes from town to town. But in some places, I look for that sort of infrastructure and that kind of appeal of a place to go, a place to sort of be seen on a vacation. And in other communities, it's more of a place to really consider living and moving to.
Yeah, some are the usual suspects. There's many from Florida, for instance, Key West among them. But you write that another one of your criteria is a Japanese culinary term, umami.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, you know, more about what that means and how you used it.
Well, it's a gut feeling. Umami is a sixth sense, if you will, that's applied to tastings of food and wine. And what it is that it's that notion that you can sort of feel something happening in the air. There's something intangible that you really cannot put your finger on, but yet when you do get there and you do get exposed to this umami feeling, you get a sense that there's a vibe, something happening. Mm. And that's what I get in a lot of the small towns that I visit from coast to coast. In a lot of the small towns that I write about in the U.S. and Canada, there are people moving in from all over the country, all over the world, who are making these small towns a better place to live, who are bringing them back to life, who are contributing in new and unexpected ways. And so you have small manufacturing towns in the upper Midwest. You have coastal communities in the South. You have Rocky Mountain forestry communities out in the West that are becoming new, redefined places to live.
I loved reading about, for instance, Traverse City, Michigan, as being one of them.
It's a great place. It has a great wine industry, and the gourmet food industry there is just enormous.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wonder if there's sort of anti-umami. You know, if you walk into a town that's just trying so hard to be an artist colony, and instead it just misses.
Well, you know, there are those kind of embodiments of the concept that you see improvised by real estate developers, for instance. The phenomenon that I talk about is more artist-driven. It's not really a government or an event that can be duplicated and cookie cutter made to order for different communities. It really has to sort of grow and happen on its own. But that doesn't prevent a lot of towns from trying to make it happen.
Right. New England claims three spots on your top 10 small art towns list. You have Provincetown, Massachusetts, which is a huge tourist mecca, mm-hmm. out on the tip of the Cape, the five college town of Northampton, Mass, mm-hmm. Brattleboro in southern Vermont, just to name a few there. But, you know, looking at this top 10 art towns with populations less than 30,000, I'd like to discuss it, but then I'd have to kill you.
Yeah, well, I don't want to die today, so thanks.
Because the number one town, it's a town I don't want anyone to know about.
You're kidding.
Well, it's...
Any town where you have $5 million condominiums has already been discovered, Robin. I hate to break it to you,
right,
but...
Right. No, it's all over for Naples, Florida. I mean, the word is out. It's a beautiful little artist town.
Yeah, but look at Fort Myers right up the road. I mean, Fort Myers right up 41 is a fabulous, affordable, culturally aware community. Now, you happen to have a lot more, say, of the strip mall development or the kind of real sort of old Florida, if you will, feeling than Naples does. But Fort Myers, just 40 miles up the road, has everything that Naples used to have, plus more, and it's not priced out of a lot of most families' reach.
Right. You know, is it like water in a balloon when you're squeezing it? You know, artists will find another place if they get squeezed out of a place that gets too popular.
Well, I think so. I mean, here where I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, we have communities nearby by the names of, say, Española and Pecos, and these are more affordable. You see the same phenomenon in communities like Aspen, where a lot of artists over the years have, of course, left town and left it to the billionaires, but they've moved into places like Glenwood Springs or Basalt down the Roaring Fork Valley. And in the case of Provincetown, you know, that's how a lot of artists ended up in Wellfleet. And it's a phenomenon. It's a cycle. It's nearly unavoidable, and you see it duplicated from town to town. It's unfortunate, but it also opens up opportunities for communities that are within the sort of sphere of influence of these small art towns.
I love you also include comments from artists and art programmers who live in some of these small towns and who are aspiring to be the winning towns. There's a wood turner in New London, Connecticut, for example, who's hopeful that they'll become the next Providence, as in Providence, Rhode Island.
Hey, I'll tell you, watch out for New London. It's got everything Providence has, only in a much smaller size and a much more affordable package.
Yeah. What are some of the other towns that are, you know, coming up?
Well, I'd have to say that there are communities like North Adams, Massachusetts, which is the home of the Mass MoCA.
That's the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art.
Mm-hmm. A great community, a very small community and a very affordable community, but surrounded by other very affordable communities that are even more affordable now. And you see this phenomenon repeated in art towns from coast to coast. But what I also discuss in this book are communities like Antigonish, Nova Scotia, on the Sunshine Coast of Nova Scotia, or Owen Sound, Ontario. Communities that are really sort of way off the beaten path that present, you know, amazing lifestyle opportunities for artists who are looking for a place to live in for, say, 6 months a year. I see that as being an increasingly common phenomenon among the creative class of artists that I deal with, is that they're basing themselves in two communities rather than just one.
Who knew? I'm looking at some of the towns, John, and I'm probably showing my ignorance, but Berea, Kentucky, Creed, Colorado, Homer, Arkansas. And just tell us, what do they do in Marfa, Texas?
Well, there's an incredible contemporary art community in Marfa, Texas that is comprised of top-notch artists from around the world who have been drawn to this little corner of the Big Bend area by the existence of the Chinati Foundation. And what they've done is they've installed cutting-edge contemporary art by some of the top artist names in the world in different old facilities in and around Marfa, like the old Wool Warehouse. Marfa, Texas is an extraordinary community that everybody should visit.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Villani, is there one town that jumped out? I mean, you knew about Santa Fe. You knew about Sarasota, mm-hmm, Florida, mm-hmm, Hot Springs, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Is there a town that you feel like, wow, I've just discovered this, and boy, this is one of the biggest kept secrets?
Well, I would have to say that Red Lodge, Montana, which is new to this book in its fourth edition, is really an extraordinary community of artists and of people with a tremendous creative integrity. This community has its own ski area. It has an incredibly agile and innovative independent bookstore. It has a creative community that is one of the strongest anywhere in the nation. And I would have to say that if mountain living is your thing, then Red Lodge, Montana is one place to look at.
Well, secret no more. Author John Villani, his book, The 100 Best Art Towns in America, is now in its fourth edition, and he spoke to us from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.